$10 a month. It's the price of a gigabyte of data for that iPad you never use. It's two overpriced coffees you ordered when you forgot to look at the menu. It's your overzealous attempts to meet the credit card minimum at the bodega on the corner. But $10 a month could be a lot more. Become a BAI buddy and commit to a recurring monthly donation to WBAI. This money will help us continue to broadcast the thoughts and perspectives of the progressive public. A BAI buddy is also not without perks. Your monthly contribution will earn you a WBAI tote bag and a member card offering Zipcar sales, discounted meals at select restaurants, and a handful of other benefits. You will also become a full voting member of WBAI, and our diverse programming will reflect your voice. Go to givetowbai.org and become a BAI buddy to support Free Speech Radio today.
This is Phil Donahue. And you're listening to WBAI New York, 99.5.
Hello and welcome to Max Politics. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. We are about to start voting in the New York City elections of 2021. Early voting starts on Saturday, June 12th, and will run every day through Sunday, June 20th. Then there's a day off, and then we have primary day, Tuesday, June 22nd. Absentee balloting is already happening by mail. So we are in the thick of it. Voting is basically here. It is time to make your final decisions if you haven't yet and make a plan to vote if you're eligible. Most of the primaries, of course, happening around New York City are in the Democratic side of things in such a heavily Democratic city. And these primaries will have a significant influence on who holds all of these positions in city government, from mayor to public advocate, comptroller, the borough presidents, and through the 51-seat city council. And there are other races on the ballot as well. We have a ton of resources for you at GothamGazette.com, so please do find those. And we have been going through a lot of the candidates and issues and races here on what was Max and Murphy until Jared Murphy's recent departure to head to nursing school. And so there are three really major elections happening right now in New York City. There's the mayoral race. We know about that. We've been talking about that in depth here on this show, and you can find a lot of coverage of that elsewhere. But the two others have gotten less attention. That's the race for New York City comptroller, the city's chief fiscal officer, a very important citywide position. We spent all of last week's show on the crowded, competitive Democratic primary for city comptroller. If you missed that, you can find the discussions in two parts under Max and Murphy, wherever you get your podcasts, or at GothamGazette.com. We did a bit of a breakdown of the candidates, why the position's important, some of the dynamics of the race. And then, of course, on previous episodes, which you can also find, we've spoken with most of the top Democratic candidates for city comptroller. The third race of great importance happening right now, and again, all these elections are very important. It is important who the borough president is in your borough. Your city council member is extremely important. Your most local representative in city government. I'm not discounting those. I'm saying more globally speaking, the biggest races in the city, mayor, comptroller, and then there's the race for Manhattan district attorney that's happening. Another crowded, highly competitive, open seat race in the Democratic primary happening right now. And Manhattan Democrats really need to get ready to vote in that election as well. And that is what today's show is dedicated to, the Democratic primary for Manhattan district attorney. In just a minute, you're going to hear a conversation I just recently had with Jonah Bromwich, a reporter for the New York Times, and Deanna Paul, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. They've both been covering the Manhattan District Attorney primary quite closely. Then later in the show, you'll hear a portion of a panel discussion that I moderated with three experts: Rebecca Roifey, a professor at New York Law School and a former Manhattan prosecutor; Daniel Alonzo, who was the chief assistant district attorney in Manhattan under Cy Vance during his first term; and Kelly Young, a reformer who is the civil rights campaign coordinator at Vocal New York, which is part of the People's Coalition for Manhattan DA Accountability. You'll hear a portion of a discussion I had with those three experts later in the show. You can find the full conversation under Max and Murphy wherever you get your podcasts or at Gotham Gazette. You can also find the full conversation with reporters Jonah Bromwich and Deanna Paul there. You can also find, as you dig into this Manhattan District Attorney primary, the 30-minute video interviews I did with each of the eight Democratic candidates for District Attorney. You can find those at the Gotham Gazette website, or we have the audio only in the Max and Murphy podcast streams. So plenty of information to get you up to speed. Now, this election is important not just for Manhattan Democrats who are eligible to vote, but really for the city as a whole, for the state, for the country. This is the top prosecutor, this top law enforcement officer in Manhattan, which obviously has major implications for elsewhere. So hope this show is helpful with these two segments with folks who are thinking a lot, covering and closely watching this race. And there's other information out there to help you get ready to vote or to know what's going on in it and the stakes. And now to help me break down this very important Manhattan District Attorney Democratic primary, the vote for which is fast approaching, we have Deanna Paul, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Jonah Bromwich, a reporter for The New York Times. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Thanks for having me.
So you've both been covering these Democratic primary for Manhattan District Attorney quite closely. There are eight Democratic candidates running spirited, detailed campaigns. All Manhattan Democrats can vote. And this is one election where there's no ranked choice voting on the ballot. So voters will be going in. You pick one of the Democratic candidates for Manhattan District Attorney, and whoever gets the most votes wins. So that's important to know. Whereas just about every other race on voters' ballots will have ranked choice voting at play because those are for city seats. All right. So let's give an overview for folks just tuning into the race or tuning in a little bit and trying to really narrow down their choice of the candidates. So let's go back and forth with a little introduction for each of the eight candidates. Deanna, let's start with you and Tali Farhadian-Weinstein.
Tali Farhadian-Weinstein comes to the race with both state and federal prosecution experience. She worked at the Eastern District of New York. She also worked as counsel to Eric Gonzalez at the Brooklyn DA's office. And prior to that, she went to Yale for undergrad. She went to Yale Law School. She was a Rhodes Scholar. She was with Eric Holder. And she has an impressive background kind of all around.
And Jonah, Alvin Bragg.
Alvin Bragg is also a former federal prosecutor, Harvard and Harvard Law. He went into the New York AG's office. And he's run an interesting campaign because he's really tied it into his biography. So he talks a lot about having a gun pointed at his head 6 times, 3 by the police, 3 by people in his block. And he's trying to run between kind of a balance of civil rights and public safety. And those are the issues that he tends to stress. Mm-hmm.
Deanna, how about Diana Florence?
Diana Florence is a career prosecutor. She worked at the Manhattan District Attorney's Office. And she resigned last year amid allegations that she failed to turn over evidence in a pretty high-profile corruption case. She says that it was one blip in a long career at the office. And she is running for the average New Yorker. She's been supported by a number of construction unions and their PACs. Mm-hmm.
And Jonah, how about Lucy Lang?
So another former prosecutor. We got a lot of former prosecutors. Race, 5 in all. Lucy Lang is a veteran of Manhattan District Attorney's Office. She worked there for about a dozen years. She is probably, it's safe to say, the most policy-forward candidate in the race. Very wonky, lots of policy. And she is the candidate who worked closely with the current Manhattan District Attorney, Cy Vance. So that's something that she has to campaign with that in mind. She has not talked much about Vance on the campaign trail, which has made sense because Vance is seen by all the candidates, I think, as someone whose tenure they would like to move on from and advance the office.
Yeah, let's come back to that theme in just a minute. Deanna, how about Liz Crotty?
Liz Crotty is another former prosecutor. When she left the office under Morgenthau, she became a defense attorney and that varies her a little bit from the other former prosecutors. Liz is the most traditional law and order candidate. She has the endorsements of the PBA, former police commissioner Ray Kelly, and recently just got the endorsement of the first responders across the city.
Okay. And Jonah, how about Dan Court?
So Dan Court is the first candidate we've discussed who is not a former prosecutor. And that's a distinction that he and the two other candidates we're about to discuss would like you to remember and to emphasize. He's a state assemblyman. He's been interested in criminal justice issues, particularly because he fought to repeal the criminalization of gravity knives. Basically, a lot of people were getting arrested for having these very small knives. He thought that was unjust. He fought for that not to happen anymore. He has fairly limited criminal courtroom experience, but he says that kind of the way he worked in the assembly fighting for these ideas will help him to run the office and to make definitive change.
Indiana, how about Eliza Orlins?
Eliza Orlins is a career public defender. She's spent her last decade working at the Manhattan Legal Aid Society, and she calls herself the most progressive candidate of all eight of them. She campaigns on decarceration, cutting the budget by at least 50%, slashing a number of the employees that work there, and really holds herself to the fact that she does not have prosecution experience, because anyone who has worked as a prosecutor has contributed to this horrible system
that she wants to dismantle, right? And Jonah, rounding out our eight candidates, Tahani Ibushi.
Tahani Ibushi would take issue with the idea that Orleans is the most progressive candidate in the race. She would claim that mantle. She has been endorsed by the Working Families Party, Cynthia Nixon, and she's trying to really inhabit the kind of insurgent energy of leftist candidates of the past. She's a civil rights lawyer. She sued the city of New York multiple times. She sued the police department. She sued the fire department. And she has personal experience with the justice system. Her father was convicted on federal conspiracy charges, sentenced to 22 years in prison. And that's an important part of her campaign story and why she's running.
So you both got at this a little bit in describing the candidates, but we have this sort of spectrum of, we have a group of prosecutors or former prosecutors. We have a group of folks who haven't been prosecutors, and they're much more on the sort of overhaul the office, a lot less prosecution, a lot more restorative justice end of the spectrum. Let's just talk a little bit about sort of the themes of the race and what it's been about and what are some of the key topics that the candidates seem to be trying to differentiate themselves on. Deanna, why don't you start? What are some of the things that stand out to you in terms of, you know, how this is shaking out? What are the differentiations in the platforms of the candidates?
So I think what's interesting is that the race arrives amid a spike in violence across the city and Manhattan. And so something that's come out during all of these virtual forums that have been held are how the candidates would handle the uptick in violence and specifically in shooting. And so you have some of them drawing from their prior experience, like Alvin Bragg. When he was at the AG's office, he created this data portal to track weapons to their original source. You have Tali, who talks about courts that she would want to create and diversion programs for young defendants, similar to ones in Brooklyn that she watched firsthand while she was working for Eric Gonzalez. Joan, I know you wrote a story about this also. Tahani and Eliza also talk about decarceration and their declination policies as ways to handle violence.
And in terms of the way that issue seems to be hanging over the race, Jonah, can we sort of tell that is something that's animating voters, or we just know because, you know, it's obviously an issue and the candidates are being asked about it repeatedly because it's a problem that the city is facing?
It's a really good question. And public polling has been extremely limited in this race. So when we think about how the public is thinking about this race, we don't even know if they're thinking about it at all, frankly. Right. Low turnout race traditionally. I will say that in the last 10 years, we've really seen prosecutorial elections generally change, particularly in the last 5 years, where we have candidates who look like Ibushi, Orlins, Court, and even Bragg and Lang to some extent, people who are pushing for reform, who are talking about the racism of the justice system, the inequities of the justice system. Those people are getting elected. But gun violence, and one could argue Donald Trump no longer being in office and in fact being the subject of an investigation of this office, has really kind of thrown a curve into this race. So speaking for myself, what I expected was that this race would look like other prosecutorial elections, in that progressive ideas would dominate. And that had been the case until, I would say, February, March, where the uptick in violence and the might of candidates like Tali Farhadi and Weinstein really seemed to change the conversation a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And as you said early on, Deanna, you know, Liz Crotty clearly running as sort of the most traditional law and order prosecutor, Farhadi and Weinstein probably, you know, somewhere close behind, although she talks quite a bit about reform. But there's a pretty big mix of perspectives here. But on the sort of further left reform wing, we have Abushi, Orleans, and Court, right? Is that fair to say? Bragg is maybe in there somewhere as well?
I think that's about right. Bragg straddles that line, depending on the topic. Mm-hmm. And then you have, yes, Tali and Liz on the right.
Mm-hmm. And Diana Florence, you know, Deanna, you spoke to this major ethics issue that has hung over her, but she's also a little bit more traditional, though she's, as you said, sort of clearly trying to frame her candidacy around efforts to, you know, combat wage theft and things that really relate to sort of working people and labor unions and people who are laboring without unions, right?
Yes. And when she was at the Manhattan DA's office, she actually headed the construction task force. And so she knows a lot about the industry and particularly how to prosecute wage theft.
And so, Jonah, how is Cy Vance and his tenure hanging over this race? We got at this a little bit. He declined to run for re-election while seemingly, you know, I mean, he's not a young guy, but he's not an old guy. I mean, he's got the prosecutors often stick around for quite a long time, but he declined to run for re-election. There are people with ties to his office who seem to want to talk about their work there, but not really want to talk about him. How does he and his record and legacy hang over this race?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question, because Vance, when he comes into office, he takes office in 2010, and he's broadly kind of thought to be one of the more liberal prosecutors in the country. He's in New York City. He wants to be smart on crime, as is the kind of talking point of that time. And what you see is twofold during his tenure. One, you see some decisions he makes that then get reported on publicly around major public figures. So stop not prosecuting some members of the Trump family on Trump Soho, not prosecuting Harvey Weinstein in 2015. He really takes a hit with those public figures. At the same time, you have a huge awareness all of a sudden about what ails the criminal justice system. There's a huge focus on it. And we, of course, see that with the conversation around policing. But that conversation is very much trickled over into talk about prosecutors. And so Cy Vance suddenly has scrutiny from people who may not even have been paying attention a decade ago when he was elected. And as you said, Ben, in this race, even those who do clearly have some relationship with him, worked under him, are reluctant to talk about those relationships.
Mm-hmm. And the other part of the, Cy Vance, you know, to some, he's been a pretty significant liberal reformer. To others, he's, you know, tweaked around the edges and kind of, you know, continued the traditional carceral system. And that's sort of a debate within this race, right? Is the question of what's your do not prosecute list? Which crimes do you want to divert? How would you approach bail and sentencing? Can you say a little bit more about sort of how that debate seems to be shaping up here? Are there specific crimes, levels of crimes that seem to be sort of at that point that separates the candidates? You know, there are a lot of them. Most of them are talking about significant reforms, but then there's always a line. Are there categories of crime that seem to be bumping up against that line?
You have some candidates that are talking about not prosecuting all misdemeanors or most misdemeanors. And I do think what's interesting about this is someone like Cyrus Vance, he came into office in 2010 and there were over 100,000 cases in the system. And he's reduced that by around 60% to 40 something thousand. And so that's already a significant departure from what the office was a decade ago. And so when you're talking about these declination policies, there's only so many things that at this point you can decline to prosecute. And so Tahani Abushi has, I think, upward of 40 offenses on her list. And I think it's the most significant declination policy. Eliza Orlins also has a pretty substantive one. And then you have other candidates who won't make that black and white kind of distinction. So Liz Crotty won't commit to not prosecuting any category of offense because you have to look at each individual case and the circumstances of each case on its own. Mm-hmm.
And Jonah, in terms of other markers and ways to try to make sense of this race, there's money, there's endorsements, there's allies, there's media attention. Do we have any other sense? You mentioned there's very limited polling. The polling we do have shows an incredibly high percentage of undecided, unaware voters. In terms of some of those other markers, do we know who, looks like they're kind of ahead of the field a bit?
I think we do. I mean, I think a combination of the factors that you just described make it pretty clear that there's one candidate who has led for, let's say, the last 2 or 3 months consistently, and that would be Tali Farhadi and Weinstein, in public polling, in fundraising, in name awareness, and what she's been able to do with that money. I mean, I constantly have people texting me telling me, oh, I just saw Tali on the Food Channel. The advertising is everywhere. She's really the code of the city in it. And so it's not surprising that in a race where name recognition means so much, she's been at the top of those polls, and she's been at the top in terms of fundraising too. Mm-hmm.
And she received the endorsement of the Daily News editorial board. Alvin Bragg got the endorsement of the New York Times editorial board. Bragg seems to be talked about, up there as perhaps her strongest competition, although some of the early polling has also shown Lucy Lange to have a little bit of a bump. But again, the polling is such a mystery overall, given the large, large percentage of undecideds. The Trump case that has been mentioned, how does that hang over this race? And again, is this another issue that do we have a sense if voters are going to sort of look at the Trump case and say, okay, I need to evaluate this field of candidates on that? Or is this another one where we throw up our hands? We don't really know what's going to motivate voters here. Probably the latter. But on the substance of this, Deanna, what should voters be thinking about in terms of this case that is ongoing? Clearly, Cy Vance is leading it as office, but given the fact that we're now in June and the next DA will take office in January, what are we looking at here in terms of the way this hangs over the race?
That's a really great question. And we'll see what happens in terms of an indictment coming forward. Obviously, we know a special grand jury was impaneled and they're looking at the case. But I think when voters think about this, they should be considering what the candidate's prior experience is and what they've done in the realm of white collar crime. And when they step forward to lead an office, how they'll be able to kind of understand the case and what's going on to move forward with it.
Mm-hmm. And Jonah, what are you thinking about in terms of how the case hangs over the race, but also, sort of what the next steps to watch for are as we go forward here?
Next steps to watch for, and what's
in terms of the case and what the next DA will just have to potentially be dealing with, whoever it might be.
Right. It's a great question. And it's a tough question. And I'll add to what Deanna said, something even more intangible, which is management experience. What this case looks like, as far as I understand the DA's office, is that it's being handled by a team of prosecutors. The DA oversees that team. That doesn't necessarily mean the DA is in there day in, day out, questioning witnesses, preparing the case. So it's a question of being able to manage that team, being able to kind of add input where necessary, and maybe above all, not interfering when unnecessary. And so one of the really interesting questions, I think, is for candidates who have said, for instance, that they want to dismantle the office, like Eliza Orlins. Eliza has said that she wants to re-interview every single person in the office. So I asked her, do you want to re-interview Mark Pomerantz, who's one of the prosecutors leading the case? And she said that she expected they would have a conversation and he would stay put. But those are questions that are really important. And I would imagine they are important to voters who care about this prosecution, which in New York, which is a very blue state, I would imagine is a lot of them.
Mm. And so if we're trying here to help voters, sort through this field a little bit, I will say You both got great coverage. People should read. I interviewed on video all eight candidates at length in 30-minute sessions, so folks can find those video interviews at Gotham Gazette. One of the things I did ask them about was management experience, because this is very much a management job. It's, you know, it's setting a vision, it's leadership, but it's also running a very large office with a lot of personnel and a big budget. Even if you want to slash the personnel and the budget of the office once you get in there, it's still a significant management job. So that's certainly one thing that doesn't always animate a lot of voters, but is a key function of the job. In terms of other things, you know, we haven't talked about, what are some other keys? I mean, one of the things I think about that comes up a lot seems to be the relationship between the Manhattan District Attorney and the NYPD, right? And there's a lot of conversation in this race around holding police accountable, about how prosecutors and police work together to solve cases or to prosecute cases. How is that theme playing out here, Deanna?
You have the candidates talking about their experience in holding police accountable or trying to hold police accountable. Alvin Bragg led a division at the AG's office doing so and investigating officers that were involved in cases that were involved with unarmed civilians, the deaths of unarmed civilians. And they did, over a dozen investigations. It did not lead to any convictions. There were two acquittals. But he campaigns on holding police accountable. You have Liz Crotty, who obviously with her endorsements is very supportive of the police and working together, and actually has called for more police even before the uptick in violence, versus candidates like Tahani Abushi, who think that there should be fewer police on the street, not going into communities. And it's interesting to think about how cases will play out at the DA's office, where you have a DA who doesn't really trust or want to work with the police.
And Dan Court has certainly been running as a hold the NYPD accountable candidate, touting work in Albany at the state legislature he's done around the repeal of the 50A law related to police discipline records. Obviously, Eliza Orlins talks about this quite a bit as we, you know, continue to get back to this sort of division in the field of those three, you know, pretty much further to the sort of left and progressive mantle and somewhat overhauling the office and the way it operates, and then some others, you know, who have different visions of reform or minimal visions of reform. Jonah, what about that theme? I mean, we hear candidates talking about holding police accountable, but a huge part of the job is prosecutors and police working together. There's also this issue that comes up around what people have termed testifying, right? Officers that can't be trusted to tell the truth. That seems to be coming up quite a bit. Again, we're talking about a Democratic primary here. As you said, you know, we expected, at least before this really significant increase in gun violence that's now been sustained for quite a while, we expected this to be a bit more of a race to the left than it seems to have turned out to be, although in Manhattan that's not necessarily always the case. But how do you see this theme of prosecutors, police playing out here?
I think that's why this primary is so important, and why I wish more people were paying attention to it, because I think it's one of the first real tests we have of where a very Democratic electorate is on policing, what they want from the police. So a year ago, obviously, George Floyd was murdered. People took to the streets. They took to the streets in Manhattan. And you saw kind of a fundamental reshaping of how people thought about policing. Now we have rising gun crime. It's not necessarily affecting all of those voters. But those voters are aware of it. They may be scared of it. And in a race like this, where you have eight candidates, we're going to learn a lot about where people are on the issue of policing and how they want prosecutors to think about policing. I think it's an incredibly important race.
Right. In some ways, it's very good that it overlaps with a mayoral primary, where obviously questions of police policing, police funding, tactics of the police, running the police department as mayor, the type of police commissioner that candidates would say they would appoint, you know, that's all been coming to the fore as well. So, you know, when we see in Manhattan the overlap of how this race turns out and the mayoral vote turns out, you know, that, as you said, will tell us a lot there. All right, we're in our final 4 or 5 minutes here with Jonah Bromwich of the New York Times, Deanna Paul of the Wall Street Journal. Let's see. Are there other things about this race, bigger themes, bigger questions that we haven't gotten to yet? One of the things, you know, that I also hear a lot from the candidates is both about what happens in the subway system, because obviously so much of subway activity in New York City happens in Manhattan. And then another thing that comes up quite a bit is these gang conspiracy cases and other sort of big cases. And then a third I'll mention is the issue of white collar crime. There's always been a fairly limited, it seems, you know, Manhattan District Attorney interest in city government and what happens at City Hall, though not completely absent. That seems to often be left to federal prosecutors and others, but certainly Wall Street, white collar crime. So any of those or something else you want to hit on in our last few minutes here, Deanna, any other sort of theme or topic that seems to be animating the race or just that you're thinking about and find interesting? I know, you know, there's all sorts of criminal justice reformers who've also been talking a lot about sort of drug policy and drug prosecutions. I mean, I could go on and on. There's so many topics within this race. But what else is on your mind there, Deanna?
I mean, I think the topic of drug prosecutions is an interesting one, and how the candidates would deal with the special narcotics prosecutor. A lot of them talk about dismantling it, pulling out the assistant district attorneys that are currently working at the special narcotics prosecutor, which deals with really serious gun drug trafficking type cases with cartels, international drug trafficking, not just simple possession and simple drug use or street crime. And a lot of the candidates talk about viewing drug crime as a public health issue and diverting these cases out of the system as opposed to dealing with them in the criminal justice system. I think that's a really interesting issue because they're all pretty different in the way that they want to handle it.
Mm-hmm. And obviously there's no way for us to, I think we've done pretty well here, but there's no way for us to go into every issue and every candidate's stances, especially with a field this big. But, you know, this is hopefully a primer for folks to then look for more information on the candidates. Jonah, what else? What's one more topic, one more theme for you?
It's a good question. I mean, there's a lot of focus both on sex work and sex crime, which actually should not, those are two completely different issues. They shouldn't be, but just to start with, let's say sex crimes, there's a lot of frustration, I think, with Vance's tenure on that. And there's candidates that talked about overhauling the sex crimes unit, for instance. That's a huge topic of discussion, and that's something that people will care about. On the topic of sex work, Vance just announced that he would stop prosecuting people who sell sex, but then there are other candidates in this race who argue that that the office should stop prosecuting people who both sell and buy sex. So there's all these issues, and that these are issues that, while they may sound dry, really affect people's lives. I mean, I think it's interesting to think about it in comparison to the mayor's race, because the mayor's race just kind of covers such an incredible array of policy issues, whereas the DA's race is really criminal justice concentrate. So if this is something you care about, the criminal justice system, this is the race in which a lot of that policy is made, and it really determines how defendants are treated, how victims are treated, how the system works. And for that reason, it should be taken seriously by voters.
All right. Well, we are going to leave it there. I really appreciate the time from both of you. Jonah Bromwich is a reporter for The New York Times. Deanna Paul is a reporter with The Wall Street Journal. I've been reading their work. Everybody should check out their work and also find, like I said, the interviews I did with the Manhattan District Attorney Democratic candidates. It's a competitive field of eight. And we are fast approaching the start of early voting on June 12th, which runs through June 20th. And then followed by primary day on June 22nd. There's also, of course, absentee balloting happening. Time is running thin on requesting your absentee ballot. So Democrats in Manhattan, read up, view up on the candidates in this race, and please be ready to vote. Thank you both for taking the time. And listeners, stay tuned for an expert panel for more on this race about some of the ways that the Manhattan District Attorney Office works, runs, or at least has been working and running under recent leadership, and what some of the key issues to watch as this campaign continues to unfold. But thank you both for the time.
And you're listening to Max Politics here on WBAI Radio, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org. This is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette. You just heard my conversation about the Manhattan District Attorney primary with Jonah Bromwich of The New York Times and Deanna Paul of The Wall Street Journal. Now, here is part of my conversation with three experts on the district attorney office, the role, questions around reform, crime, prevention, and much more. This is a portion of that conversation. If you want the full conversation, you can find that under Max and Murphy, wherever you get your podcasts, or at the Gotham Gazette website.
Hello, and welcome to a special discussion on the race for Manhattan District Attorney. I'm Ben Max from Gotham Gazette. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm joined for this special discussion by three expert guests. They are Rebecca Roifey, who is a professor at New York Law School and a former Manhattan prosecutor. Thanks for being here, Rebecca.
Thanks for having me.
Daniel Alonzo is a litigation partner at Buckley LLP, a former federal prosecutor, and served as the chief assistant district attorney in Manhattan during Cy Vance's first term. Dan, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
And Kelly Young is a Black Christian lawyer, community organizer, and Brooklyn native working towards Black liberation. And she's the civil rights campaign coordinator at Voices of Community Activists and Leaders, known as Vocal New York. And Vocal New York is part of the People's Coalition for Manhattan DA Accountability. So thank you all for being here. Kelly, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So this race for Manhattan District Attorney, the Democratic primary, is open to Democratic voters in Manhattan. It's also known as New York County. If you see that on your ballot, it's technically a state office. It's not part of the city government elections that are happening, although it's happening at the same time. So it has a little bit of a different voting system. As many should know, ranked choice voting is at play in the primaries that relate to city government positions, but there's no ranked choice voting in the Manhattan District Attorney election. You pick your top choice, you get one vote when you go, and whoever gets the most votes wins, even in this crowded race of eight candidates. And those eight candidates are Dan Court, Eliza Orlins, Liz Crotty, Diana Florence, Tali Farhadian-Weinstein, Alvin Bragg, Lucy Lang, and Tahani Abushi. Now, there is a discussion of the candidates and their stances that I hosted with Jonah Bromwich, a reporter for the New York Times, and Deanna Paul, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, that is also part of this special episode on the Manhattan District Attorney race. So with this expert panel, we're not going to really dig in so much on the candidates and their platforms and what they're running on and who they are, as we are about broader issues of how the Manhattan District Attorney office works, why it's important, some of the calls for reform, some of the ways that the office deals with crime, and many other issues. All right, so let's get into our discussion here. Rebecca, let's start with you. How do you see the role of a Manhattan District Attorney? What is the job, and what do you make of sort of some of the calls around changes to the office, how it should function, what it should look like?
So, you know, I think the Manhattan District Attorney's Office is an incredibly important office. Whoever inherits this role is going to affect the future of the city. And because the city is the center of so much in the country, it also has significance in that regard, too. I also think it's really important to think about the history of the office. And this is an office that has had the history of professionalism and I think excellence, to sort of put it briefly. And we are in the midst of an ongoing conversation about what those two things mean in the context of prosecution. And I think that's a really important conversation to be had. What I think, though, is that to dismiss the entire office and the central mission of the office as a part of, you know, the state violence or a perpetuation of Jim Crow is mistaken and misguided. So there is a way to think about this in an ongoing conversation about what this office, how this office ought to improve on its mission and goals without throwing out the baby with the bathwater.
Dan, why don't you continue on that, and then we'll come to Kelly for thoughts on some of that more serious reform. But Dan, what else would you say about what the office is and what it does?
Well, first of all, I couldn't have said it better myself. I mean, that was that's exactly right in my view. And obviously the history of professionalism is very, very important. I mean, to give a little bit of historical perspective, this office was very politicized for the first, 150 years of this republic, or maybe a little less. And, you know, it would be that you know, politics was the only thing that mattered. You know, what ward boss was supporting the DA, what district leader, et cetera. And so the office was very politicized into the 1930s, such that it really didn't even go after the problems of the day, which were essentially racketeers who were extorting legitimate businesses. And that all changed in 1937 with the election of Thomas E. Dewey. And since then, we've had a largely apolitical, notwithstanding that the DA needs to be elected, a largely apolitical outlook on the role of the office, and the other DAs have come along. So, you know, no longer are assistant DAs hired from, you know, the local political clubhouse, which is what it was, you know, from the 1930s and before. That's very important in this race, by the way, because there's a different kind of politics that's kind of permeating here, which is not so much the politics of the clubhouse, although obviously the political clubs have made endorsements, but it's more this kind of progressive versus more traditional, right? We're not talking conservative. We're talking about, you know, traditional liberal versus far left progressive is what we have here. And you know, there's a danger, I think, that the office will get politicized again. I mean, some of the candidates, particularly the ones who are the most progressive by their own indication and by Kelly's organization, the least harmful, you know, the ones that would do the least harm to people, they have said outright that they're going to fire large numbers of assistant DAs. And that, to me, carries with it an enormous risk of losing the professionalism of the office, the quality of the lawyers, and it carries an enormous risk of politicization. One candidate, just you asked for examples, Dan Court, has actually said, you know, we should no longer be looking for the best and brightest like Cy Vance does all around the country because we have perfectly good lawyers here. Now, I don't disagree with the fact that we have perfectly good lawyers in New York, but why on earth wouldn't we look for people, you know, who are the best and brightest around the country? So I'm very concerned about the politicization.
You're getting at a little bit of the job of sort of running a big office. We'll come back to that in a second. Kelly, your view, your organization's view, your coalition's view, what is the role and where should it be heading?
So the district attorney is the top law enforcement official. That is the role, and it is an important role because of the enormous unchecked power that they have. And, you know, both of my co-panelists mentioned the history of the office rooted in professionalism. I think what's missing from that conversation is that for the entire history of that office, it's been run by white men. And the perpetuation of Jim Crow is absolutely involved in the office because the crimes that are, or the behaviors that are being criminalized are rooted in racialized laws designed to control and harm Black and brown people. I mean, I think that is something that can't be ignored, and to the extent that it is, you know, swept aside is dismissive of the lived realities of people in Manhattan and in New York City. And as the top law enforcement official, DAs can't respond to harm in a manner that is rooted in values of fairness, equity, and restoration. And they can't be directly accountable to community members themselves. And we've seen this. And so it is, you know, the position of Vocal and the coalition that we are a part of, that the DA needs to take steps to reduce its presence and ultimately withdraw its presence from community programming. And we're going to talk about reform and this emergence of progressive prosecutors. But at the end of the day, there's no progressive way to cage people. And that needs to be, you know, front and center when we talk about the power that the district attorney has and the tools that they have, which are incredibly limited.
So, Rebecca, in terms of the job, is it more in your mind than prosecuting crimes? I mean, what, you know, should the district attorney's office be running community programs? Should the district attorney's office be involved in all sorts of alternatives to incarceration? What does that picture look like? And what's your view on what the proper sort of imprint of the office is?
Right. I mean, as I said, you know, this is an office that has always been focused on excellence. That doesn't mean it's always done the right things. The state of our understanding of what it means to be a prosecutor and how to be an effective prosecutor has changed over time. I think Cy Vance's office has made a lot of progress, as did Morgenthau's in, you know, looking at alternative mechanisms other than, you know, simply putting people in jail. And the state of empirical evidence is certainly that these long sentences are not effective. What is effective, though, is not just community programs. It's community programs coupled with sure, swift prosecution. And so I think we can do these things together. We can reduce incarceration by reducing the length of sentences without eliminating the role of prosecution, which is so critical in keeping these communities safe, which is also part and parcel of the office's function. So the short answer, absolutely. They should do what they have been doing and do more of it and do it in a smarter way. But I don't think giving up the tool of prosecution is right or empirically based. That's not the way we make our city safer. And it's not the way that we protect communities, all communities, and particularly communities of color.
Dan, one of the biggest discussions in this race is about do not prosecute lists. Different candidates have different lists of the offenses they don't want to prosecute or that they would look to do alternatives. What do you make of that discussion? Some have longer lists than others. Some want to take a lot of things case by case. Where does that discussion stand in your mind?
Well, first of all, I should say that I agree that it's within the authority of the DA to decide not to prosecute large categories of crimes. I think the only remedy for that is political, right? Vote the person out. If you don't like the crimes, she's not prosecuting.
I actually wanted to ask you about that after your answer to my first question, but while you're there, isn't the district attorney supposed to sort of follow the laws that are decided by the lawmakers, you know, by the laws that are on the books? Or how does that discretion play out? If that discretion is being exercised to a really significant extent, doesn't that really make it a very political office?
Well, in one sense, it does. I mean, obviously, you know, you don't want individual cases to ever be decided by political considerations, but the people can, for example, elect a DA who wants to focus more on one kind of crime versus another. It's a political question. And New York law is very clear that the discretion of the DA is, you know, practically absolute. There is a different political remedy other than voting them out. By the way, the governor can supersede the district attorney on particular cases or in general if that's what he wants to do. So there are political remedies to if people don't like that. I was about to say, though, I think it's incredibly unwise to have these blanket categories. Certainly the candidates who have the largest blanket categories are Eliza Orlins, Dan Quart, and Tahani Ibushi, to a lesser extent, Alvin Bragg. But the categories are, some of them are very, very important. I mean, let me give you a couple of examples. So we have Eliza Orlins, for example. She has six misdemeanors that she's going to prosecute, right? They involve, I don't have the whole list, but it's something like sex abuse and domestic violence and things that are important, obviously. But everything else, unless there's some extraordinary circumstance, she won't prosecute. So in another part of her platform, she wants to hold police accountable, right? That's a big buzzword, hold police accountable. By the way, I was a prosecutor of police officers. I obtained convictions against multiple police officers in my career. It's not hard. It's not easy to do, but it's an important thing to do. You need all the tools in your toolbox, including the misdemeanors, to hold police accountable. So, for example, we prosecute police for official misconduct. That's a misdemeanor. Making a punishable false written statement. That's a misdemeanor. Tampering with witnesses in certain levels is a misdemeanor, right? If you're going to do away with misdemeanors, you're going to handcuff yourself. But probably even more importantly, on a more broad point, it is the way that the community, you know, through the state legislature speaks and says, look, these are things that we believe are wrong. And so having a blanket policy, I think, is a terrible idea. Having a policy that gives you incredible discretion or that will do diversion in large categories of cases. So, for example, when the current DA is currently diverting every shoplifting case, right? If there's a problem, it comes into the system. But otherwise, they're offering diversion before the person even comes to court for shoplifting. You can argue with whether that's wise or not, but it's one way to meet this criticism that the system is over-criminalizing. The last thing I want to say is that you should know that we've always had some categories. Everyone's always had some list. So when I was a young ADA, and I don't know if Becky remembers this as well, but I was told we don't prosecute fortune telling, we don't prosecute adult obscenity, and we don't prosecute adultery. You know, those were crimes that were on the books back then. Some of them still are. So it's not like there's never been such a list. It's just doing it in a blanket way really does what you said, usurp the will of the legislature, even though the DA has the technical authority to do it.
All right, Kelly, what about do not prosecute lists? What about what should be prosecuted in your mind, if anything? You know, that one of the things obviously that draws a line in the discussions in this race and a lot of the broader discussion right now in New York politics and government and society is about violent crime, gun violence. What's your stance on what should and shouldn't be prosecuted and how different crimes fall on that spectrum?
Thank you. So I guess I first want to respond to what Rebecca said about needing prosecutors for the public safety of communities, specifically communities of color. And that greatly ignores the trauma, abuse, and torture that these communities have felt at the hands of district attorneys. And we can't separate that out. And another thing I want to, you know, encourage us to acknowledge is the difference between crime and harm. You know, because we know that there are a lot of things that are criminalized that aren't harmful, and there are a lot of things that are harmful that are not criminalized. And a lot of that has to do with what we look like, how much money we have, what communities we're a part of. And so when we just say, oh, this thing is a crime and that's the will of the legislature, you know, we know that, you know, it is the law that slavery is abolished except as punishment for a crime. And then after that, several crimes were created in order to criminalize free Black people. Like that is the history of our criminal legal system in this country, and it cannot be ignored. And so we're not saying that there is no harm. We absolutely know that what we are calling for is for governments and legal professionals to change the way we respond to the harm and look at root causes. And that is something that district attorneys cannot do. And it's something that they shouldn't do. There's no reason why district attorneys should be gatekeepers for resources that community needs. We shouldn't have to go through district attorneys to get access to treatment, to get access to job services, to get access to all of these things that should already be in communities. And so, yes, do not prosecute lists are important because it is a corrective tool. At this point, the only thing that district attorneys can do for communities is reduce harm. And having these lists reduces the harms that community members are facing. And again, I feel like the question is going to say, but what about victims? And again, that even the dichotomy between victim and perpetrator ignores the fact that on any given day, those are the same people.
You know, I wasn't going to say that. Could I jump in, Ben? Sorry. I wasn't going to say about victims. I was going to say communities of color, in my experience, are not a monolith. I mean, there are many, many, many people in low-income communities and communities of color who come to the DA's office, come to the police, and ask for lots of help. So this mm-hmm. is not, I don't think this is a uniform position. And I'll also say that a lot of the crimes on the do not prosecute list had nothing to do with, you know, post Jim Crow, you know, trying to enslave people. You know, commercial burglary, which Tahani Ibushi and Dan Quart won't prosecute. They just won't prosecute it. I'm not sure why, but, you know, if people are burglarizing stores in Midtown without physical injury and without burglar's tools, they just won't prosecute that. And it makes no sense to me. And it doesn't particularly have much to do, in my view, with what Kelly's saying. Why would we not hold people accountable, in the words of this race, for burglarizing stores?
Go ahead.
Can I respond to that,
please? Yeah, absolutely. Let me just add in what I wanted to ask you, which I think you can merge, which is why I'm adding it in. But, you know, one of the things that I think you're getting at that sometimes gets missing is people talk about, these do not prosecute lists. And what you're trying to put on the table is the alternatives in terms of harm reduction and restorative justice and things like that. So I was going to ask you to sort of mention the viewpoint on that as part of that. And perhaps you can merge those.
Yeah. I'll try. To Daniel's point, though, I absolutely understand that people of color are not a monolith. As a person of color myself, what I'm saying is, though, I'm encouraging you all to think about the reasons why people of color are going to prosecutors and police officers for help. And that is because they have been deprived of resources in their communities to address the harms that are being caused. And so there's this call for reducing the footprint of prosecutors and reducing the footprint of police also is, on the flip side, a call to invest in these communities so that we do not have to go outside of our communities for help. You know, the laws as they've been created, and then I think your failure to see the ties between, you know, Jim Crow laws and how laws are being enforced today is incredibly telling, because at every stage of the criminal legal process, communities of color are disproportionately represented. And that is a direct legacy of Jim Crow laws. To your point, Ben, with, you know, the calls for restorative justice and transformative justice, it's really a reorientation in how we target root causes and how we empower communities to, you know, think of different ways to address harm. It's because we're not saying that these harms are not going to exist, but we can't persist. We can't survive with this, you know, knee-jerk reaction to throw people away only to have them come back into the community, having been, you know, re-traumatized and brutalized by the system. And so it is a call, one, for resources in communities and for programs in communities that make it so that people who do commit harm, we are positioned to address those root causes, and we are positioned to, you know, have interventions that make it so that that person can be brought back in the community without being isolated, without being brutalized, without having the stigma of having even touched the criminal legal system.
And we unfortunately have to leave that discussion there. But if you want to listen to the rest and the full audio of that expert panel, you can find it at GothamGazette.com or wherever you get your podcasts under Max and Murphy. There's a lot more that we got into. I hope this whole episode has been useful to you. If you are a Manhattan Democrat, please do get ready to vote in the district attorney primary. Until next week, this is Ben Max from Gotham Gazette. Talk to you soon.
This is Eric Anderson.
This is Rosie Perez.
You're tuned to WBAI.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen? This is Sellout Cool J.
This is Dave Marsh.
Hi, this is Tony Bennett.
Hi, this is Julie Cruz from New York City, and you're listening to
WBAI FM.
The soundtrack of New York City.
Non-commercial and with no additives. We're listener-supported.
I don't listen to the radio.
I don't like stuff that sucks.
You talking to me?
I love this radio station.
You talking to me?
Hi, this is Hannah from WBAI's premiums department. As you may know, WBAI now has a new phone number to call to make donations or to pledge for premiums at 212-209-2950. Thank you for being a WBAI member and for making a contribution to keep the station afloat. But if you have a question about a premium, please do not call that number. All the call center can do is take down the info and send it to premiums@wbai.org, and time on the line costs us money. Instead, please email us directly with your question or concern. The email is premiums@wbai.org or call 212-209-2870. We promise to get back to you within a week's time. Again, please call 212-209-2870 if you have a question about a premium you ordered, or email premiums@wbai.org.
Stand with the sun.
Orange, New York, and the Assange Defense Committee invite you to tune in to a very special event. Julian Assange's father and brother, John and Gabriel Shipton, will be arriving from Australia to conduct a four-week-long, 18-city marathon speaking tour, Home Run for Julian. They hope to educate people about Julian's arrest, his persecution, and the legal case where the U.S. is currently requesting his extradition from the U.K. in order to face trial here for espionage. It is the first time in history a publisher has been charged under the Espionage Act, now over 100 years old. Guest speakers will be the satirist and radio host Randy Credico, journalist and television host Chris Hedges, journalist at The Gray Zone Aaron Mate, and composer, Pink Floyd co-founder, and activist Roger Waters. That's Thursday, June 10th at 6 p.m. right here on WBAI New York.